The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee plays a vital role in shaping the future of Milwaukee and Wisconsin. UWM's diversity, academic excellence, and major public research contribute to the region's economic development and quality of life. Meet the people behind the creativity and discoveries at UWM today. Here's the host of UWM Today, Tom Lujack, Vice Chancellor for University Relations and Communications.
One of the most amazing functions of our brain may be the ability to form a memory and then recall it later. It happens constantly, and yet that process of making memories is something that scientists are still trying to understand. At UW-Milwaukee, we are fortunate to have one of the world's leading researchers studying how the brain forms memories. On this edition of UWM Today, we're proud to introduce you to Fred Helmstetter. Fred is a distinguished professor in the psychology department, and in the last decade has been awarded millions of dollars to conduct his research into how the brain functions, especially how it makes memories. Welcome, Fred. Great to have you with us.
Thanks. Great to be here, Tom.
So the brain is such an amazing organ and such an amazing part of our body, and yet we don't know all that much about it yet, do we?
There's still a lot more questions than answers, I think, at this point. So lots of things yet to be discovered.
Why is it? Is it because it's so hard to look into? I suppose an arm or a broken finger you can see, but you know the brain has been hidden away, isn't it?
Well, I think the technology's gotten better in terms of how we can look at it. But I guess the answer, there's a couple of different answers. One is just a technical answer in that the techniques that we use to study the brain have gotten better recently, but for many years, certain processes were not measurable and easily monitored. A more philosophical answer would be the brain is basically who we are. It's the organ of the body that determines our personality and our consciousness. And studying it is by definition complicated because we're studying who we are.
Looking in that mirror and trying to figure out, who am I seeing?
So it's a very complicated organ.
How did you first get interested in studying the brain?
Through psychology, I think. As an undergraduate, I was interested in how learning happens, how animals and people learn. And that led me eventually to take a more mechanistic approach and start to look down into the biology of it and figure it out at that level. And that's the direction I've been going for the last 30 years or so.
And that's the really fascinating thing about your research. As I was doing research of my own for this program and began to dig into the type of scrutiny that you've brought to the brain, it really is biological, isn't it?
Yeah, all of it is biological. I approach it as a biological question. So what are the physical underpinnings of these complex phenomena like memory that we're interested in? So for us, it reduces down to how the organ functions. What's the biology of the brain and nervous system, and how does that set of processes allow us to do what we do?
Now, your specialty, as we mentioned at the beginning, is memories.
Mm-hmm.
How do you define a memory?
Well, a memory is there are a couple different ways. I think the easiest way is it's going to be a change in your behavior as a result of some experience. Okay, so it's something, you know, and you have to differentiate that kind of change from lots of other kinds of changes, like just being tired or having some physical problem with your nervous system that causes you to not function correctly.
And from the standpoint of studying that memory, I mean, we all have them. We bring them around and we recall them. But your analysis is looking at what is going on inside that organ that actually creates the memory. Right?
Sure. So we look at how the nervous system changes in response to that experience. So at the behavioral level, we know a memory is formed because you're doing something different because of what you've been exposed to, what you've learned. At the biological level, the issue is finding what has changed. So what are the physical properties of the nervous system that have changed? And we do that a couple of different ways. Another kind of interesting issue with the brain and with the study of memory in particular is that there are lots of different ways to look at that process. So we can look at it at a very molar level. We can look at it as at the behavioral level, what a person does, what are the properties of how we arrange stimuli to help you learn and remember. and how we measure it behaviorally. We can look at it at the systems level. What particular parts of the brain? So the brain's a complicated organ. There are lots of different regions that have different specializations and that talk to each other and interact. At the systems level, what are the parts that are important, maybe more important than other parts? And then kind of moving down from that within, say, a patch of tissue in the brain, how do the individual cells talk to each other? How do the circuits interact at the network level? Beyond that, we get down to synapses, the specialized connections between the membranes of neurons, and then the molecules at those synapses that actually encode the change that produces the memory.
You hear a lot of talk about the genome project, how we've been able to map the genomes of the body and, you know, using super calculating or computing strength to get there. And that amazes me that we're able to go ahead and peel back the onion in that fashion. How much do we know in detail of that biological function in the brain? Are brains all functioning pretty much the same, or do different brains behave in different manners?
Well, I guess there's two ways to answer that. So genetics is important. Your genetics determine to some extent the way processes related to memory work. And in some disease states, we see a link between your genotype and your, say, likelihood of developing a disorder that's related to memory. But I think more relevant to the kind of things that we do is the idea that your genetics are not a static thing. Your genome is there, but the way that DNA is expressed changes dynamically in response to the experiences that you have. So just actually having this conversation or, say, learning a new set of nonsense words or learning somebody's phone number, that relatively innocuous, simple experience actually changes the way the cells in your brain express different genes. The activity driven by that experience changes which parts of the DNA are expressed, which proteins are then made in the cells, and then those proteins go on to actually be the substrate for how the function of communication between cells changes.
Do we know what's orchestrating these biological functions?
Well, that's a lot of what we study. So there are some fairly complicated biochemical cascades that happen in cells in response to experience. There's no one real easy answer to that because, as I mentioned a moment ago, there are multiple levels to how to look at it. So the answer might be you might have one answer for one set of cells and a different answer for a different set of cells or at a different time within a particular network of neurons. And also, all memories are not created equal. So my example of learning a telephone number would be one kind of memory, but for another kind of memory, you might see a different, slightly different biological process underlying it.
And people form different types of memories, even though they may be exposed to the same sort of stimuli, right?
Well, I guess that's difficult to address in terms of individual differences, but I can tell you that one of the things that we study in the laboratory indicates that exposure to a relatively simple relationship in the environment or a simple set of stimuli produces several different memories at the same time. So, for example, in our laboratory studies, and we try to simplify things as much as possible in terms of what the person or the rat, depending upon the experiment, is learning. In those laboratory studies, we'll do something as basic as taking a signal. A particular stimulus appears on a screen, and it'll be followed by an outcome, say a loud noise or a reward or some kind of something scary in the case of fear conditioning. Well, programming that relationship actually engages multiple circuits in the brain, and you learn several different things with that very, very simple. I mean, it's kind of the most basic experience. You know, this happens, then this happens, right? Not a difficult problem for memory in general. But even that really simple procedure produces multiple different types of memory in the brain simultaneously, which are subserved by different circuits. And we can look at that. We can, for example, in human imaging studies using non-invasive measures of brain activity.
Like a CAT scan or MRI, mostly.
Yeah. Functional magnetic resonance imaging. We've also done magnetoencephalography, which is slightly different, but still gets at the brain's activity in real time as you're performing these tasks or forming these memories or recalling them later. We can identify different separate circuits that are active that correspond to different elements of what you learn. Some are directly related to your ability to say, oh, the blue square comes on, then a loud noise comes after it. You can articulate that knowledge. But others, which maybe aren't as accessible to your conscious awareness, are also happening at the same time. So we have lots of different things going on in parallel, which, as I said, often relate to activity in different parts of the brain.
I spent a lot of years as a news reporter before getting into this line of work here at the Academy. And out on the street covering stories, we often would walk up to people who were eyewitnesses to an event and ask them to recount what they saw, what they recall. And I remember vividly shaking my head out on the street after talking to two or three people who were standing there watching the same event unfold, and they had different memories. I recall one story, completely different idea of what transpired in front of them. Mm-hmm. What's going on there?
Well, that's not really my area, but it's certainly a practical issue and an important problem. One thing I can tell you is that when you think about memory, you don't really want to think about it like a digital recording or taking a video of an event. It's a little bit different than that. And one thing that's very interesting that we've learned a lot about in recent years is the idea that memories change. They update. It's not simply a passive, reflection of the actual events that transpired, but things get modified and changed. And a lot of people study this full time. It's not really my area, but I find it kind of interesting. Our work has been focused more on looking at what are the biological processes that enable the memory to update and change. So, for example, when you recall something, again, in our experiments, it's a very simple piece of information. It's nothing as complex as witnessing a scene or a crime or something. But when you recall something, those synapses that strengthen to encode the memory actually destabilize. New molecules are created. Old molecules are broken down. And the structure of that synaptic connection changes. Now, normally, if nothing new happens, if there's no new information to incorporate or nothing disruptive happens, like I don't manipulate the nervous system with some biochemical thing or other experimental treatment, that memory pretty much stays intact and it gets restabilized over time and you continue to have the information. But if something does change, if new information is incorporated or we mess with the process, like prevent the cell from making new protein or change gene expression in the cell, we can make the memory go away completely. So it becomes labile when it's used and then reincorporated. Now, we never used to think that was happening. It's only been, say, the last 15 years or so that the study of this has really picked up. People used to view it as more of a recording device, but it's clearly not. Clearly not. It may appear that way if nothing changes, but your example is a good one in terms of practical limitations on memory and eyewitness testimony. And we have good experimental support for those types of things now too.
I always imagine the brain sort of like a word processor, you know, where you can cut and edit and delete and, you know, a mechanical process taking place, not understanding what that is. But as I hear you describe the role that proteins play, for example, in forming these, that's, pardon the pun, but that's mind-blowing to think that there's biology or chemistry at work in your brain that is creating the ability
sure.
to
And most people don't. I mean, you wouldn't normally think of it. I mean, you wouldn't normally just kind of reflect on that in your day-to-day life unless you were studying it. But one way that people might be able to relate to it is just to appreciate the fact that any experience that you have, any memory that you form is actually the result of a physical structural change in your nervous system, although we take it for granted. But I mean, people who study the brain are used to this. We take vision for granted. Those of us, you know, who have normal vision look around and we don't think about how the mechanics of it work or being able to walk, right? Those things become extremely important when something happens and you can't walk or you can't see and you want to fix it. But there's a complex biological series of processes that allow you to do that. And some people spend their whole lives trying to break it down and understand it at a very mechanistic level. We do that for memory.
Fred, do you ever pinch yourself when you're doing these experiments, when you have these moments of discovery and say, wow, this is unbelievable?
I guess I'm really not that not that reflective. I just kind of come in every day and try to like solve the next small problem. I really love what we do, but no, I don't think I've ever pinched myself and said wow yet. I'm in the moment and kind of enjoying it on a day-to-day basis.
See, and maybe because I know so little about the work that you're doing, I probably would be terrible in the laboratory because I would keep saying to myself, I can't believe this, you know, molecules and proteins moving around, and that's why.
Well,
why
I think the impression, if you were involved in the work, things don't seem to move very quickly when you're right there. I mean, it's always one more experiment or one more smaller question, and all of those small questions come together to kind of give us a big picture. So.
The work of a scientist. You have to be steady and patient.
Sure.
You're listening to UWM Today here on WUWM. So good to have you with us this week. I'm Tom Lujack. Joining us in the studio is Fred Helmstetter. Fred is a distinguished professor, actually a terrific title. There are only a handful of folks at the university with that title, having spent a career studying the brain. And on this program, we're talking about more specifically one of the functions of that brain, and that is memories and how they're created. Fred, you've done a lot of work looking at how stress has an impact on the formation of a memory. Tell us about that.
Well, there are kind of two ways to look at that. One is the idea that stress and intense types of experiences that you have can modify the normal process through which you store memory and change it in various ways. The other way to look at it is just the memory for the stressful event itself. And we've done a little bit of both. One thing I can tell you is, and it may be common sense to most people listening, is that things that have intense relevance to you are remembered better. Things that produce intense emotional reactions are remembered better.
Birth of a baby,
sure. And we have this phenomenon that people often refer to as flashbulb memories. You know, if you're you know, our age, where were you when Kennedy was shot, or what have you, when the World Trade Center came down? Those intense emotional experiences tend to change the way memory is stored. And that's a very interesting set of phenomena in terms of trying to understand how things work at the circuit level. There are some parts of the brain that are more often related to emotion, anxiety, things, stress, that also participate in memory. Some of them actually function directly in the process of storing the memory, and others function as adjuncts to modify or modulate the communication between other parts of the brain that may be more directly related to the information you're storing itself. But these other influences make it better or worse depending upon other factors like your level of stress.
Any evidence that a really good event that forms a memory is easier to hold on to than a memory of something traumatic?
That's a really interesting question. It's often, at the experimental level, it's often very difficult to have an even playing field to compare those things directly to each other. We're limited by what we can do in the laboratory. Many of the laboratory animal studies use very simple rewards, and it's sometimes hard to generalize. I don't know that I would make a blanket statement about that. I can tell you that there are pathologies associated on both sides. So on the aversive or stressful side, we have a whole host of psychological disorders, particularly anxiety disorders like post-traumatic stress disorder and other things, that seem to result from dysregulation in the brain circuits that normally tell us about danger. So we learn about danger very readily, and there's an obvious survival value to that. But unfortunately, what often happens is things go wrong so that people respond inappropriately to things that aren't dangerous, but they respond with the same types of reactions that you would to something that was dangerous. And that's something that we're interested in, although we don't do any real clinical work. I do collaborate with people who are into that, and we're interested in it. So that's an important issue. On the upside, drug abuse, things like that. So there are brain systems that are there to tell you when something rewarding happens and make you go back again, but sometimes going back again is not a good thing. So we have different types of disorders on the positive hedonic side that can also relate to dysfunctions of how you process that memory and how that memory guides your behavior.
I suppose all of us are struck and could right now recite a handful of different events that have happened to us where we had an enormous – where the events had an enormous impact or made a huge impression on us at the time. And we thought, my God, I will never forget this. And then as time goes on, you begin to lose the edges. You begin to, mm-hmm. to not recall quite as vividly that impact of that, the birth of your first child or your wedding day. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't the brain, if it's that important, you would think that would be in the lockbox. That would be one that you pull out and, you know, it is never going
to
change.
Well, it's hard to say. Certainly in the case of things that are dangerous, you would think it's a good idea to keep that pretty close to where you can use it, use the information.
Don't put your finger back into that.
Precisely. And it's not rocket science, right? Uh-huh. So it's not difficult to see why we would have evolved a series of systems that keep us away from things that we've had bad experiences with. The problem, of course, is, you know, if you know that this thing is not scary, if you know that you're not going to, you know, die if you go up in an elevator, yet you can't go up in the elevator, right? Then it's a problem, and you need to do something about that. So some of the research that we do in terms of modifying memories, modifying stressful memories in the laboratory is applicable to treatment. So if we can change the way those connections were made, or we can understand how things get miswired in the pathological conditions, we might be able to develop treatments or at least contribute to the development of treatments for fixing it or treating it.
Does one gender play any role in memories? Would a man or a woman?
There's a literature on that. I think I don't know the literature on gender differences particularly well. It really goes back to something that we mentioned earlier about there being different kinds of memories. So some people have argued that in certain memory domains, like say spatial memory versus verbal memory versus other things, you might see gender differences. But you know, in general, from what I can understand of that literature, when people do find gender differences, they're so small to as not be interesting for some people. If you really look, you can find differences between genders. And I'm talking only human stuff at the moment. There is a slightly different literature for laboratory animals. But yeah, there are differences, but I don't think that they change our fundamental understanding of how the process works in the brain. In some cases, they inform it, but it's never really been my interest, so I can't really say much about it.
I have to admit I'm a little disappointed in hearing that, because if my wife were here, I would be able to say, you see, dear, that's why I don't remember that third date that we had.
I can't get you off the hook.
37 sure. years ago. But you remember that, don't you? Yes, I do.
Well,
sort of.
Not to get you into any trouble, but it might be more important to your wife than it was to you.
Yeah.
Or the emotional reaction might have been larger.
Let's talk about the equipment that you use to measure. 15, 20 years ago, could you be doing the work that you are today identifying the detail that you do in the biology?
Probably not. I think for the human subjects work that we do, we rely heavily on non-invasive imaging technology. And luckily, we have a really excellent group right here in Milwaukee, some of whom have been instrumental in developing a lot of that technology. I think that the fundamental processes that we use, like fMRI, bold contrast, haven't changed much, but things have grown a lot in terms of the technical capability and spatial resolution, temporal resolution, how we analyze the data, et cetera, and so forth. For the more molecular work, there's been a huge, huge growth in the last 30 years in molecular biology. You mentioned the Genome Project and all that goes along with that, and the accessibility of techniques that allow us to get really, really fine resolution on individual genes and how they change their levels of expression and how they contribute to these processes at the molecular level. So, yeah.
Are you able to do a lot more non-invasively by measuring this, or do you sometimes have to go in, especially on animals?
In the animal studies, it's typically we look at the tissue postmortem.
Okay.
So whereas in the human studies, obviously, it's all non-invasive. We do some non-invasive imaging in the laboratory animal studies, but most of the if anything where you're actually doing quantitative protein assays, you know, the brain has to come out.
On this program over the years, we've had a number of faculty at UWM involved in studying the aging process and the challenges that come, particularly in terms of loss of cognitive skills mm-hmm. because of dementia or Alzheimer's. Is any of the work that you're doing at this point pointing towards any answers to those questions that, you know, frankly, haunt a lot of families?
Sure. Well, I mean, one general comment I could make is that the study of basic processes and memory is very relevant to those types of issues because memory is almost like the canary in the coal mine for cognitive impairment and aging. It's one of the first things that you can pick up reliably in terms of a behavioral change, and it is a really good predictor for disease processes like Alzheimer's disease. I don't study aging directly, although I do collaborate with some people that do, and we have an excellent group here on campus that looks specifically at the neurobiology of aging. So we have people who look at it in terms of the biophysics of the cells and how cellular physiology changes as a function of age. And we also have people who look at human aging and study brain processes in people and populations as they age and what changes.
Going forward, what do you think it will take for us to indeed answer some of the questions, well, many of the questions that are still in front of us? Is it going to be improved equipment or imaging gear that you might be incorporating, or will it take some fundamental breakthrough in how we understand what the changes in the biology actually represent?
Well, that's hard to know. And it's hard to be clairvoyant. I can tell you that any change, any significant improvement in technology allows us to do experiments that we couldn't do before. And we're therefore able to push back the edges of what we know. In terms of a fundamental breakthrough, those are hard to predict. All I can tell you is that if the current funding climate for biomedical research in the country continues to go on the trajectory that it's on now, it's much less likely because there'll be fewer people out there in the trenches trying to find those things, and there'll be fewer opportunities for that breakthrough to happen.
And that's the tragedy we've talked about on this program a number of times, the decrease in funding for basic scientific research.
Right. It's getting extremely difficult to do basic science.
And some politicians may say, well, show me the results. I mean, we should only invest in research that demonstrates some economic impact or some economic.
I understand that. But it's, as I said, it's very difficult to be clairvoyant. So you don't know what's going to be significant down the road. And not having the knowledge is the only sure way to not have it be significant.
Yeah, well put. In terms of your own research, we have a minute or so left. What's next? What do you see happening in the next couple of years in your laboratory?
Well, we're getting really into this idea of memory stability. So what are the signals in the brain that when you activate a memory, make it labile, make it in a position to be updated and changed? So we're trying to dig into that and kind of get down into the molecular biology of that, what particular genes are important, and how the process works. So that's been one of our recent passionate interests.
And you're working, of course, with faculty at UWM
yes.
as well as other institutions,
sure. mm-hmm.
medical college and,
yeah.
and others in town.
Mm-hmm. You bet.
Amazing work. Fred, thank you so much for taking time to describe what you're doing as you study the functions of the brain and those memories that sometimes are so near to us and dear to us and some that we want to forget.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Fred Helmstetter, UWM's Distinguished Professor of Psychology, our guest on this edition of UWM Today. That's all for this week's program. We will see you next week at the same time. Take care, everybody. I'm Tom Lujack.
You have been listening to UWM Today, the weekly program where you meet faculty, staff, and students at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee who help make a difference in the lives of people in southeastern Wisconsin through their teaching, research, and community service. To learn more about UWM, go online to uwm.edu.